I think the real distinction there for me between the Jobs and Branson ways of talking about passion is the Jobs way is much more inward looking. And the Branson says for you, but he also says for the world. And when we look at folks who experience well-being, let me take a step back. When we look at folks who have greater meaning in their life, we find that often those folks are thinking about how what they do affects the world and other people.
That's Daniel Lerner, author and psychology professor at NYU. I spoke with Daniel during IBPA's Publishing University 2018 in Austin, Texas. Now, why is Daniel Lerner mixing it up with independent publishers? Simple. He's talking about passion that leads to happiness. And what is a better fit for publishers than that? We'll hear the whole interview with Daniel in just a minute. But first, let me welcome you to Inside Independent Publishing. Thanks so much for streaming in. I'm an independent publisher, and I'm your host, Peter Goodman. Inside Independent Publishing comes to you from IBPA, the Independent Book Publishers Association. IBPA's mission is to lead and serve the independent publishing community through advocacy, education, and tools for success. For more about IBPA and how it can help you be a better publisher and sell more books, whatever kind of publisher you are, go to ibpa-online.org. Now, if you have a question for me or anyone at IBPA, just contact us on the IBPA site or message us on Twitter using the handle at IBPA. Be sure to put the word podcast in the message so your question gets to the right place. As I mentioned, in early April of 2018, I attended IBPA's annual Publishing University, which was this year held in Austin, Texas. A terrific day and a half packed with publishing information. And while there, I was able to speak to nearly a dozen experts and publishing industry leaders. And I was also able to speak with the keynote speaker, Daniel Lerner. Let's listen. Just a reminder, we are here at the Publishing University 2018 from IBPA, and we're in Austin, Texas this year. As you know, we're talking with a bunch of different experts and presenters. And today, I'm very pleased to be talking with Daniel Lerner. Daniel is a clinical instructor at NYU. He is also the author of You Thrive, How to Succeed in College and Life. And he just finished a presentation that was very happily and passionately received. He was a keynote speaker today, and his presentation was entitled Passionately Successful, Making the Most of Ambition and Happiness. And one of the people sitting at my table stood, kind of held his head in his hands, and I thought he was sorrowful, and he just had a look of beatific joy on his face saying, I am so inspired. I know what to do now. So this was like a really great, one of the great IBPA presentations, and if you weren't here, I'm sorry you missed it. But anyway, Daniel is here today, and I guess we could call him an expert on happiness. And I've been in publishing for 30 years, and I don't necessarily associate happiness with the word publishing. So when you were asked to present to a bunch of independent publishers, knowing as you must that they struggle all the time against enormous odds, how did you approach coming here, and what did you think you were going to have to say to these folks?
Well, it's a great question. First of all, thanks for having me here. It was really a pleasure, and it was kind of a unique honor to be able to speak with these folks. Because having written a book and having struggled through that, gone through those challenges of writing one, and having friends who were involved in this business, I get it. You know, I guess I take it from two different perspectives. On the one hand, struggling is part of our culture in increasing, we see it more and more and more every day. So as I talked about today in the keynote, you look at traditional measurements of success in our culture, let's say who makes the most money, lawyers, doctors, for example. And then you look at their levels of depression or unhappiness or morale, and they're super, super low. So, you know, I can walk into a room of lawyers, which I have, and know that they're struggling with well-being, even though they're making considerable incomes. I can walk into a room full of doctors, which I have, and know that they're making even more money, but their morale's at 6%. I teach college students, and I figure they're going to be, well, many of us figure they're going to be thrilled. They got into college with an amazing 4 years. But I know, based on recent research, and 90% of them have been stressed out, and 60% of them have felt very sad on campus. So walking into a room of folks who are accomplished, driven, and challenged to find happiness, sort of doing the Sisyphus thing every day, that is nothing new, because look across our culture, and that's everywhere. That being said, coming into a room specifically with book publishers is unique and wonderful, because I think when folks go into investment banking, medicine, or law, they expect to make a really good income. It's part of the deal. But going into book publishing, I don't know if that's part of the, mom, I'm going into book publishing because I'm going to be a gazillionaire, right? So some of that has to be about love or a passion for what it is they're doing. Belief that books can change the world, or books can change one human being, or books are important for us to be well. So it goes beyond just making the money. And that's one of the reasons I was so looking forward to coming in here. Knowing there are folks who are doing things from their heart. Yes, they were struggling, many of them, but they were doing it, the foundations of which were a really beautiful foundation.
Well, it is a struggle, I'm sure, for most publishers. Do you think that some publishers, in fact, you remember the story you used to tell when you were a French student in high school, if you ever were, about spending time in a garret, somewhere in Paris, lonely, writing poetry and that sort of thing, and actually getting some sort of twisted joy from the passionate struggle against the odds and against the establishment. I wonder if that's a part of the joy that an independent publisher gets is, not making a lot of money and working really hard.
Well, you would all know that better than I would, for sure, as independent publishers. But I imagine you're right. I mean, imagine it's not even like music where maybe someday, look, there are songs written about, and the one that comes to mind for me is the one by Boston. We're a band playing in the middle of nowhere, and an agent gets out of his big fancy car with his big cigar and finds us, and now we're big and famous. I don't know any songs like that about book publishers.
No.
So, or artists, visual artists, or dancers. I think for a lot of them, they're like, who knows who's going to see me?
It is kind of a badge of honor for artists, I think, to be struggling in a way. And in fact, when you make it big as an artist, the first thing you hear from your friends is that you're a sellout.
Yeah, that's right. You can't win either way.
Yeah.
It's an interesting thing. And one of the main topics, I should say, that I think about, that I've written about, that I speak about, is how do success and happiness coexist? When do success and happiness coexist? And do a lot of work in positive emotion, really talking about the advantages that positive emotion can give us when it comes to neurological processing. So if I ask you or any of the listeners out there to think of the happiest possible memory you can for the next 30 seconds, and then I teach you words in a foreign language, research will show that you'll probably retain about 35% more of those words than someone who is primed to think of 30 seconds of their worst possible memory. 30 seconds will make you more creative. We see in the research 30 seconds, 45 seconds will help you do better on SAT and similar tests. So the question often comes up, well, that's great, but what about the creative artists who need to be depressed, need to be down, the Jim Morrisons, the Janis Joplins, all those folks? And look, I can't argue against the fact that they were wonderful performers. And I'm not going to say what would have happened if they were happy, because clearly those were folks who thrived in that way.
But they get older, as they become mature.
Well, they never
artists.
Did get older. That's the problem with Jim Morrison.
Right, sometimes it just led to a very, very dark space. But those who did get older, they kind of said, well, yeah, that's what it was like when I was young, but now I got a family, I'm more mature, and I find that, my art is, just as satisfying to me as it was back in the days when I was struggling. So maybe there's a maturation factor that comes in.
That's the thing. People are going to change. People hopefully going to mature and realize what works in different phases of their life. I'm curious. Also, even in, what about the artists who do well when they are happy, right? Say, and we talked about Maya Angelou today. Right. Harry Connick Jr. is someone I always am curious about, because he talks about how he folds many of his passions in, whether it's acting or singing or dancing, his family, his daughters, his wife, all these things are important to him. But even the folks who go between happiness and challenges to happiness while they're actually creating, is there a darker place that helps them sort of come up with ideas, but then a happier space that allows them to share them differently. You know, we can't put a whole blanket over I'm happy or I'm unhappy. It's really about where are you in the moment.
Yeah, it's hard to switch it on and off.
Yeah.
I mean, I suppose you can, you know, think about certain things and make yourself morbid, but it's hard to, like, just, you know, make yourself happy. But I mean, people take drugs for that reason, right?
Right.
They drink or they smoke weed or something and put themselves in a completely different mindset so they can forget, maybe.
It's a great point. Is that happiness or is that forgetting?
Yeah.
You know, and we do have some really strong, empirically sound interventions that raise people's levels of happiness. You know, I mean, and for folks, you know, since we're talking to publishers here, one of the strongest involves writing. It's called the Gratitude Journal. And what we've found in research that's been replicated many, many times over is if you take 5 to 10 minutes at the end of each day and you write down 3 things you're grateful for, but also why you're grateful for them, not just I'm grateful for my partner and my dog and my view, but, you know, I'm grateful for my partner because when I have a rough day, I come home and she's there to really listen to me. And today I had a good day and she was there to share that with me. So we do that 5, 10 minutes at the end of every day. At the end of about a month, we see a considerable rise in levels of positive emotion. And it's not just because we're tricking ourselves into it. It's because for some folks, they'll wander through the day thinking, well, I have nothing that I could possibly be grateful for. But now I have this assignment that I have to do. So what am I going to find? And you find it's not 3 things. It's like 30 things. You just don't think about them. So basically, you're rewiring your brain to see the world a different way. We can look at a number of other interventions. Exercise compared to medication when it comes to mild to moderate depression has a very, very similar outcome. Meditation, we've seen great research on that, and a number of others that I'll stop there. But so we can raise our level of positive emotions. It just requires effort.
Well, yeah. I guess if you're going to exercise, I mean, yeah, you really have to put some time into it, and then you have to get into the exercise, maybe push yourself. They say that your body is washed with, what do they call them, pheromones or something?
There are a whole host of different factors that come into play. Yeah.
So maybe that's a kind of a drug, and maybe it's
For some of us, you know, like myself, I have to push myself. Like my workouts, that's my first domino. If I don't, I'm not physical. It's really hard for me to be happy, and I really have to kick my own butt. But for other folks, it's just taking a certain amount of steps every day, like making sure you're walking your 10,000 steps, whatever it might be. And it's not about running up the hill. It's just making sure you're moving. So it's like finding the one that's right for you.
Take the steps instead of the escalator. You mentioned the Gratitude Journal. Yeah. And, of course, that brings me back a little bit to publishing, because people publish these various kinds of journals, how to be happy, how to be this, how to be that. In fact, I think a lot of the IBPA members publish books on spirituality, happiness, contentment. There are a lot of these how-to titles about how to lead a better life. And they're very aspirational and they're very engaging. A lot of them are, you know, extremely well done, and they're done very passionately. And no doubt there is quite a market for such books in this country. And so I'm wondering, going back to the idea of you have all these wealthy people doing well who are nevertheless unhappy, would you maybe summarize America as a very powerful country with enormous natural resources, and yet somehow fundamentally American culture is, I don't know, wallowing in some sort of unhappiness? I don't want to get into politics necessarily,
maybe after we finish it.
Well, we don't have to name names, but I mean, people are angry, right? They're at each other's throats. They're casting aspersions on each other's parentage, etc. And it's not pleasant, and no one feels like we're in a happy space. And I wonder, this is very far afield of what you were talking about, but if America were a person, right? what could you possibly suggest to America to sort of get happy, to take all this wonderful stuff you have, all this passion and ambition, and don't use it for ill, you know, use it for happiness? What are some of the things that I really put you on the spot here?
It's a great question. It's a super challenging one, but it's a great question. I think there are lots of different ways to look at it. If I was going to start with one, I'm a big fan of Van Jones. You know, and he had this series where it's how do we bring people together to talk?
Yes,
I've seen how do we help other people listen
on CNN, right?
Yeah. And I mean, I've been a fan of him. Just I really appreciate his perspective on things and his desire to bring people together to talk and people to listen. And I, you know, when we talk about individuals, what's the most important factor in let's say well-being rather than happiness, right? And well-being being a deeper construct, being beyond positive emotions. Well-being includes meaning and includes engagement and relationships and achievement too, in addition to happiness. So when I think about the well-being of this country, I would think about like a person to say, start off with the relationships. To your point, we're casting aspersions of people who we don't know in many cases, and we're immediately dismissing anything that anyone else on the other side believes. Clearly, they're idiots and fools, and other words that certain politicians are using these days, which means that we're not hearing each other at all. And I think it's one of the big challenges. If you want, to bring it back right back down to individual differences, I think one of the underlying factors for any disagreement that people, from almost any disagreement that people have, whether it's at home, whether it's at work, whether it's walking down the street, is why can't you be more like me? If you were more like me, then you'd appreciate what I just did. If you were more like me, right, then you'd know why I want a gun in my house. If you were more like me, you'd know why I believe what I believe when it comes to abortion, so on and so forth. But the conversation of, well, why aren't you more like me? What are you all about? That doesn't seem to be happening very often. And I would say, just like in our own households, when we have to really sit down to hash out an issue and go, maybe I'm not understanding you right now. I would argue you have to do the same thing in this country.
So the things you talk about, being ambitious and passionate, do you feel that there's any sense of that being a kind of a self-centered belief that would, or a self-centered enterprise that might prevent you from being more empathetic to other people? Or does a concentration on your own healthy happiness ironically lead to a better understanding of what makes other people happy as well?
So again, a great and really complex question. Let's take it from the passion perspective first. I'd say there are a couple of different ways. There are many different ways to look at passion. And we discussed two of them today, as defined by Robert Valorand, who's a really remarkable researcher at University of Montreal. And that's harmonious passion and obsessive passion. There are two statements by businessmen which I've always caught my attention for their difference. One I shared today, which is the Steve Jobs idea about passion, which is you have to be passionate about something because it's so hard. Otherwise, any rational person would give up. So the way that he's looking at it is it's really hard to pursue a passion. You have to be a little crazy, you know, and that statement's really all about the individual, right? You have to be irrational, right? Because it's so hard for you. If you look at what Richard Branson says about passion, it's at first it's a little cliche. I don't have it right in front of me, but it's basically pursue those things in your life that you're most passionate about. You're like, okay, well, that's a little commencement speechy. But then he goes on to say, in a way that serves the world and you. I think the real distinction there for me between the Jobs and Branson ways of talking about passion is the Jobs way is much more inward looking. Mm-hmm. And the Branson says for you, but he also says for the world. And when we look at folks who experience well-being, let me take a step back. When we look at folks who have greater meaning in their life, we find that often those folks are thinking about how what they do affects the world and other people. So my colleague, Adam Grant, at University of Pennsylvania, a wonderful writer also. He wrote Give and Take Originals, and right now it's called Option B with Sheryl Sandberg. He and another colleague, Angela Duckworth, who wrote Grit, I'm going to give them both credit because I can't remember which one of them did the research, but they both talked about it. They speak to an array of different people in different professions. The one that comes to mind for me are firefighters. Why do they do their work? And it turns out that the firefighters who include in their answers, answers about the community and helping the community, those firefighters tend to have higher levels of meaning in their lives. Meaning is related to harmonious passion. So can it be selfish to be passionate? absolutely 100%. If you're not thinking about anybody else, yeah, you can pursue whatever you want to pursue, and who cares? But if you include other people and you ask yourself that question, how does it help the world be a better place? And or how does what I do help other people? Then, and really think about that, discuss that, write about that. Then we're looking at the opportunity to raise our levels of meaning and to develop passions that are more outwardly beneficial.
Do you think that's hardwired into the species, or is it something that our religions kind of have emphasized for the sake of the survival of our civilization, so that we don't kill each other off? It's like manners, you know.
Right.
Why are people polite? Well, if they weren't polite, they'd, you know, they'd eat each other's food and kill each other eventually.
Right. You know, again, you're asking great questions, and they're complicated. I love this conversation. Thank you for asking such great questions. So you're going to get arguments on both sides there, right? I mean, from the religious perspective, the argument would be, I trust you because we believe in the same God. So I'll lend you money, or I'll give you wheat or seed, because I know that we both know that if you don't give it back to me, God will strike you down. But that guy over there with the yarmulke, you know, or that guy over there who's not praying to the same, you know, who's wearing the frock, like that guy who's not my religion, I don't know what he believes in. By the way, I mean, make the yarmulke crack because I'm Jewish. So I feel like I can do it. David Brenner used to do that on stage. Right. I can joke about Jews, and then he'd pretend to have a heart attack.
Yeah.
But more different when it comes to religions. Oh, I don't really know what you believe in. So I think that is one of the first schisms that happened. One of the early schisms. You know, we also came up in a – we evolved in a system where – are you going to kill me when I walk up to you on the road, or are you going to help me? We had to be incredibly careful because we didn't know. And so one of the arguments for how we've evolved from an emotional perspective is that we have all these different ways to show negative emotions on our face – fear. Right, because if I'm running away from a saber-toothed tiger, before I even have language, I want my fellow cave people to see the fear on my face, so they run away too. Disgust, meaning don't eat this because it's probably poisonous. Anger, meaning you better get away from me before I hit you in the head with my axe, right, or my bone, right. We don't have a whole lot for positive emotions because we don't have a whole lot of room for them early on. But recently, we've developed more opportunity to feel safer. Better Angels of Our Nature, a book that came out, Steven Pinker, arguably, you know, one of the great thinkers of our time, argued, and this is 6 or 7 years ago, that we currently live in the safest time in the history of the world. Now, we might see things on news feeds all the time that convince us otherwise, but the odds of our neighbor walking over and hitting us in the head with a hammer, you know, to take our sheep is slimmer than ever. Violent deaths are way, way down. Yes, we hear about the awful, awful gun violence.
So do we kind of get off on anxiety, and we kind of sort of develop this sense of victimization in a way because it excites us in a way that happiness doesn't?
It's stickier. Mm. Like we need to know.
Right.
We need to know if we're in danger, because if we don't know that, we're dead.
Yeah.
We don't really need to know as richly that we have the opportunity to laugh. And again, evolutionarily, we're like, you know, we've moved what? One millionth of a millimeter in the last 100 years compared to, you know, our whole evolution. So this is a long arc of a journey. And what we're finding now in the research is that there are tremendous benefits, as I mentioned before, to priming ourselves with positive emotion. There are benefits to friendship beyond safety in numbers. We actually get a chance to thrive, not just survive, but to thrive. I think we're starting to realize that now. I think we've known it for a while, but the research is bearing that out. And what is the role of engagement, being deeply focused on something? How does that affect us? How does that affect our well-being and our ability to both survive and to thrive? So, I think it's definitely stickier, and the media takes advantage of that.
Yeah.
You know, they want us to that headline.
Right.
You know, far more likely if it's going to affect us in a dangerous way than if it's going to make us happy.
The adrenaline rush of fear and the shaking with anger, those are compelling, and they kind of wipe every other thought off of your out of your brain, but if you're meditating, you're content, it's not exciting in the way that like those other motions are. So those
let's just stick a pin in that for a second. I think you really hit that. It's an important point, which is when one meditates, they're far less likely to dwell on that incredibly challenging or negative news.
Right.
They're more
right.
likely to take it, to really think it through without the at least with far less attached emotion, and be able to make a decision in a very different way.
So is this? I really have to, you know, the job insists that I bring this back to publishing somehow. You know, is this maybe some way that a publisher could approach the hard decisions that they have to make? Is that they really kind of have to go to a quiet space and not obsess so much about all the hard details they have to deal with? That they're likely to make better decisions if they approach it quietly and out of a sense of some contentment?
Well, you know, the challenge there would be that it's clearly all about the individual, right? So if there's far be it for me to argue that Steve Jobs should have been different and therefore he would have been more successful. He might have lived longer, but, you know, he did pretty well. Far be it for us to say, as you just referenced before, if only Jim Morrison was happier, right? Wouldn't the music have been better? So when it comes to decision-making, are there some publishers out there who thrive on the thrash? They thrive on the angst? Maybe. But I think there are a couple questions to ask. How does that affect them as human beings overall?
Right.
And what would happen if they decided to just take a test? Whether it's try to meditate every day for 10 minutes for the course of 30 days and see how their decision-making changes at the end of the 30 days, not just for themselves. I actually recommend you involve someone else, their partner at work or at home, other colleagues, to say, I'm doing a bit of an experiment here. Or I did an experiment. Have you seen any change? Either that or yes, to prime themselves and say, automatically say, before I have a big decision, I'm going to think about something for 30 seconds that really makes me happy. You know, I'm going to try that and see what happens.
Right.
You know?
So I think that's a great takeaway from this session for all you publishers out there who are struggling. Should I acquire this book? How should I market this? I've got a difficult author. How am I going to deal with it? Instead of jumping in and obsessing about it, take a little time, sit quietly, examine your own thoughts, and make sure that you're coming at the problem from kind of a quiet space and not just raging the way you know you always do.
May I add to this?
Sure.
You know, it's what strikes me is that I'm talking to a bunch of publishers downstairs after the keynote, is that so often when I come across folks who are both who are creative, who are successful, and who have well-being, they make time at some point, whether it's during their year, during their month, to step away from everything. They'll go for a month, I mean, if they're able to do so. You know, one of my best friends is a photographer, and like he leaves basically for a month. He's like, I'm going to Carnival in Trinidad. See ya. You know? And when he comes back, he's very different about it. His ideas are different. He right. has really had a chance to think through things. He's at peace. When I've talked to a number of musicians, I need to take a few weeks or a month away just to think. And I come back and my music is fresh. And I would imagine it's the same for writers to say, you know, I need to take a little time away to really be inspired.
I'm sure.
So why don't we do it ourselves? Why don't we, as folks who work with these people, like take a look at them and say, well, how does your writer do their best writing? You take a step back for a second. Maybe that's it. So if it's tonight, I'm going to have dinner with my family. I'm not going to think about this. Or I'm going for a run and I'm going to kick my own butt and I'm not thinking about it. Or whatever it might be, whatever your meditation, whatever your space is, take that space and then come back and revisit. You know what? Take a nap. Because the way that our brains work, I mean, it's fascinating. I could go through lots of research that when we sleep for even 15 minutes, what our brain allows us to process when we're sleeping is extraordinary. So take a nap. Take a walk around the block. Take time with your friends or family. Then make that decision. Because that space will often allow us to make a decision that's not based on simply emotion. And it's better thought through.
Great. Well, thanks. That is really terrific advice. If you've learned nothing else, the lesson is go take a nap.
That's where I'm going.
Yeah. All right. Well, Daniel Lerner, thank you very much for coming by. I really appreciate it. It was a really great conversation. There was a lot more I actually wanted to talk about, but maybe next time. Thanks
Part
again.
Part two. Thank you.
All right.
Well, I hope you're suitably inspired by what Daniel Lerner has just said to go up to your bedroom and take a big, long nap. What will come to you in your dreams, I wonder? That book title you've been struggling over? The decision as to whether to kill off your main character or let her live so you've got an excuse for a sequel? Or maybe you're wondering how you're going to pay your printing bill and you can't get the anxiety out of your head. You just need some time off to switch off your brain. It's a lot easier when your passion and your working hours intersect. A number of years ago, circumstances led to my company acquiring another company, a moderately successful children's book publisher. I worked to keep it going for a few years, acquiring new titles, illustrated books mostly, and keeping the backlist more or less in print. But at some point, I realized, you know, I'm just not a kid's book kind of guy. It's not that I don't appreciate a good one or never bought them for my kids, but I don't really get them, if you know what I mean. I don't really know what makes one good and one not so good. So I didn't really know how to evaluate what I was investing in, and I didn't really relate enough to the genre to learn. I probably could have studied up, read more, hired knowledgeable people, but in the end, to be honest, I just didn't really care enough about kids' books to do that or to do them justice. And so I made what I think was a smart decision, to just stop trying to do them. My time was limited, and there were many other things I got pleasure from. And mind you, I had an ongoing line of kids' books, and few were generating decent revenue, but I didn't really connect with them and just didn't want to spend my time working in an area that I couldn't connect with. So I really stopped completely looking for new projects in that line. Now, by the same token, I bet there are lots of publishers who would have zero interest in working in the areas that do give me pleasure, that I connect with now. Translations from the Japanese? Books on drinking tea? Really? Well, it's that diversity in independent publishing that makes us great. And all of us can be happy in our own way. I think the worst thing is when we are blocked from our pursuit of happiness by our obsession or commitment to things that are fundamentally unhealthy or uninteresting. Every once in a while, it's a good idea, as Daniel Lerner says, to step back, take some time off, and have a chance to contemplate what's important and where our passions really need to be directed. So, okay, it's nap time. Now, if you'd like to comment on this program, tweet to me using the handle @PeterGoodman or @IBPA. And just a reminder, if you're already a member of IBPA, we appreciate your support. Be sure and let us hear from you. If you'd like to learn more about IBPA or considering joining, check out the IBPA website at ibpa-online.org. Thanks again for listening to Inside Independent Publishing. Keep your nose in that book. And as my boss in Japan used to say, let's have publishing fun.